All right, so we'll just start off with, can you tell me your full name?
Frank Davis Connett Jr.
And when and where were you born?
I think Methodist Hospital, in 1921, December 31st, 1921.
Tell me a little bit about your parents. What were their names and what?
Well, my father's name was Frank D. Connett. My mother's name was Lucretia Brenton Connett. She taught school in Kentucky in a one-room schoolhouse, and all they had was a Bible, the only book they had in the Bible. She was an elocutionist. My father was a farmer and involved in politics, but he never held public office or ran for public office. He just liked politics. The family had about a 1,000-acre farm when World War I broke out. And Grandpa Connett had him deferred from service to help him run the farm. His oldest brother was already in the Army, and another brother ran off and joined the Navy, and another was on a contract in Arkansas, and he had one too young, so he needed somebody to help him with a 1,000-acre farm. So when World War II came along, he had a small farm, and he told my brother and I, Calvin, that he could probably defer one of us. But he said, I don't recommend it because it's not very nice. People think you're a 4F and they say bad things to you. And when the war's on, if you're not in the war, rather, you're pretty bad. And it was an unhappy time for him. And we both said, no, we don't want to stay home, we want to go. That was a different time, I guess. Later on, Gordon Schaefer and I sponsored a Hi-Y group, and the Korean War was... the Korean War broke out. And we asked these high school kids what they wanted to do. And they all wanted to join the Navy and have shore duty. Not a damn one wanted to fly an airplane, drive a tank, do anything exciting. All they wanted was Navy and shore duty. So times changed somewhere.
What branch of the military did you serve in?
Well, I tried to be a pilot, and I got sick in acrobatics, and so they fired me off and made me be a walking mechanic, and the rest of my life was boring. I went to India and China and Guam, but they're just fixing airplanes for other people to fly on. It's very boring, because nobody ever shot at me, and I never shot at anybody.
So after the war, after you came home, what did you do then?
Well, I went to law school. The first 2 years, I started out at St. Joe Junior College in 1941. And I guess it was 40. Anyway, that was the smartest thing I ever did, to go to St. Joe Junior College. I had really good teachers. I was there 2 years. And when I got back, then I transferred to University of Missouri, and University of Missouri took every single credit I had at Missouri Western. And I had good teachers. After the war, I went down to University of Missouri. I originally wanted to be a highway patrolman. I thought that was great. They used to have wrecks near our house, and I'd go running down there where the wrecks were. But then I decided I'd rather be an FBI agent. And I wrote J. Edgar Hoover a letter and asked him how he said 87% were lawyers and the others were mathematicians. Well, I flunked algebra. So I figured I better be a lawyer. But once I got to studying law, I was so fascinated with that I didn't want to do anything else. And I made it through with the skin of my teeth.
And I think I got ahead of myself a little bit. Can I go back and ask you about your grandparents?
All right. Well, my grandparent was Squire Connett, S.S. Connett. I don't know where the S.S. is. Squire Shedrick. Nobody knows where Shedrick came from. But there. And they had 9 children.
And what did he do?
He was a farmer, and he was active in the highway department as a commissioner, and it was his slogan was "Get Missouri out of the mud," and that's when they started building hard highways, pavement. He helped out with getting right of ways. He took an active interest in it. He was on the State Highway Commission. Anyway, he went down to see a woman about helping get a right of way, and she didn't want any highway going through her farm. And he said, "Well, it's coming anyway." And they did. It ran 169 right between the house and the barn. And later on, she said, "Well, he'll run for office and I'll get even with him," but he never did. But later, that's the farm that my father ended up owning after World War II. And so he had that same farm that ran the barn thing through. But I don't see where that's of any great interest to anybody.
Do you know how your family came to be in St. Joseph, in this area?
Well, yeah. He was, he came here in 1839 from Kentucky, I guess. And he's known as Major Connett. I don't know what kind of a major he was. But he was 6'7", which was big in those days. And he'd been some kind of Indian thing, I think. I don't know, anyhow. So he settled there and had 3 or 4 children and had some more children. No, I don't know what happened to the girls. They didn't keep track of them as well as they did the boys. Isn't that awful? And they were closely connected to the Brown family and the Leonard family. Solomon Leonard, he was the first judge of this circuit, this area, Northwest Missouri, and I never knew it until I was trying a case up in Maryville and they had his picture there on the wall, and that was my great-grandfather.
So, where did you grow up in St. Joseph? What part of town?
Well, I went to Sparta Grade School, a one-room schoolhouse. I was the only one in the 4th grade.
Huh. So, were you the smartest one in the class then?
Yeah, I also the dumbest, I guess. Well, I remember, you sure you want to hear all this stuff?
Absolutely, I do.
Well, I remember I was supposed to do some short division problems. And I didn't get them all done at home, and I didn't get them all done before the teacher called on me. And she saw I had handed it in and it wasn't enough. And she says, "You know what I told you last time?" I said, "Yes." And all the kids in recess, "Frankie's going to get a whipping. Frankie's going to get a whipping." So they all, my good friend Billy Gentry was going to stay and watch it because the teacher sent him on. And we're all through and she got down the switches off the backboard and started wailing away on me. And they broke those switches and she got some more. And she was hitting on my legs And I took a deep breath. I was trying to keep him crying. I took a deep breath and she quit. Because she liked me. And I liked her. And the best thing that ever happened to me. I don't remember ever not having an assignment after that. But she was really a nice lady. And she cared enough about me. And most teachers nowadays would just give me a demerit or something. But she cared enough about me to make me do right. She should have whipped me from my handwriting, too. But then later, I got to listen to the upper grades. We were all in one room. And so somehow they transferred me to St. Joe. My folks had to be, not rode with my uncle, because some cousins were going to Central. And I went to Sherwood. But I can't see where anybody's interested in all this.
Well, is there much left of the Sparta area anymore?
No, that's where the first the county seat was.
That's right.
But they got more votes in St. Joe, and so they moved it.
So after you came to St. Joe, you attended
Sherwood and then Central.
Do you have any memories from that time that you want to share?
No. I was good in history and English, stuff like that, and terrible in mathematics. I took algebra, flunked algebra, but I took logic in junior college, and that counted as a math course. I did all right in logic, but I didn't like it. I guess I didn't like memorizing, I don't know.
Well, what was St. Joe and Central High School like when you were a teenager?
Oh, I don't know. Lots of girls. I always liked girls. I like chasing at them. I didn't really want to catch one. I don't know. We had a great principal, Calla Varner. She gave out the diplomas when we had graduated, and she didn't even have a list on them. She knew each and every student by name. And she was honored by, there used to be a radio program called This Is Your Life. And it was on national radio, and they came and did it on her life. Surprised her. Calla Varner. Finally.
What year did you graduate?
19, spring of 40, I guess.
And so you went to law school?
Well, I went to junior college.
You went to junior college?
I took flying lessons there. That's the last tantrum I threw. I had to get my parents' permission, and my dad, like he always did, to ask your mother. So she said she wasn't going to sign. Yeah, so I threw a tantrum, stomped and yelled and screamed. So she signed.
So why did you decide to come back here after law school?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't any outstanding student. We started out with 85 in the class, and I think 17 or 18 graduated. At that time, you could go to law school if you had 60 hours. And everybody could go that wanted to go. But they flunked out if they didn't make it, and most of them didn't. And now it's different. Now they take a test. I took one of those LSATs. I got a hold of one of them, looked at them. How the hell I couldn't have passed that test? I don't know. Do you need all this stuff you're asking me?
Well, what I'm trying to do is I'm interviewing different people from kind of basically all walks of life. And my hope is that people will actually listen to them. Because I think they're important. But once you start to listen to them, you kind of get a sense of what life was like in St. Joseph during that time. And I'm hoping people will use this for, you know, like local history research. Now, if there's anything you just don't want to share with me, if you don't want on the record, that's fine. You don't have to tell me. But this stuff is important because it paints a picture of what St. Joseph was like throughout the decades. So it's okay. The stuff that you think isn't important is the really important stuff, is the stuff that might be, you know,
okay,
lost to history otherwise.
Well, I thought this just brought me back to Greenleaf's case. We haven't got there yet.
Well, we will get there. But I'm building up to it. I'm building suspense.
All right.
So did you start a practice? Did you go to work in a private practice after you came back from law school? What did you do?
Well, I starved to death. I lived at home and with my folks, and I drew some wheels in my kitchen, my house where I lived, and some fellas asked me to run for a job as a magistrate against Pat Olmsted. And I ran and I defeated, and it was a good thing I did, because I knew the law, but I didn't know much else. And John Downs offered me a job as assistant prosecuting attorney. I made $65. I started in August of 1946, I guess. And the next year, full year, I made $600 some odd for a full year's work. And so John Downs offered me a job as assistant prosecutor. And I told my mother I was going to go, and she said, "Don't do it. You'll never leave the courthouse." And I said, "No, I'm just going long enough to get enough money to buy a car." Here I was, you know, graduate and everything else. Didn't even have an automobile. So I stayed, but my mother was right as usual. I stayed there 8 years in the prosecutor's office and 30 years as a judge. So my mother was right as usual. And that's what I was doing when the Greenleaf case broke.
And so you said there were three assistant prosecutors?
Three assistants, yeah.
Who were the other two?
Gordon Schaefer and Bill Nibe. Gordon Schaefer and I went through law school together. I don't know where Nibe went to law school. But Gordon and I went all through school together. Through law school together. He was married at that time.
Okay, now we can get to the main event if you want.
All right.
So, 1953.
All right.
Was the year it happened.
Well, so I went to work in 52 from down there. Well, I can tell you what I know about it from my own personal experience. Is that what you want?
Yeah.
Okay. I was out to Bonnie Hedy's house. I don't know quite why I was sent out there, but I was there, and they were digging up the body, and there was a lot of lime, I remember, to try to get it decomposed faster, I suppose. Mrs. Leonard Jacks, lady, she was Judge Duval Smith's court reporter and later became mine. She was taking notes as they were digging up the body and what was going on. And John Downs told me that J. Edgar Hoover told him he wanted us to file a murder charge against Carl Austin Hall and Bonnie Hedy. And so he told me to go draw back to office and draw one up, and I did. And then the next day, the Highway Patrol picked me up. They had the body in the trunk. They were taking it to a mortuary in Kansas City, I suppose. And I went with them. And they let me out at the airport. And I remember getting my shoes shined while I was waiting. That was the days when people did that. And people were talking about it, and I knew what it was all about. And it's kind of funny feeling to everybody talking. All I had to do was say I'm there, and you know, a lot of talk, but I didn't want to say anything. And I flew down to St. Louis, and the prosecutor's office, one of their prosecutor's office came and picked me up, and he kind of put me in my place. He asked me how many assistants we had, and I said three. I said, how many you got? And he said, 23. So he delivered me to the clerk's office to file my papers. And I walked in, and I never saw so many people. They were all yammering at me and everything, and wanting to ask and yelling questions and so forth, and I never saw anything like that. And so the clerk was real nice, and he said, would you like to come in my office? I said, I sure would. And went in there and filed my papers. And he said, the United States attorney wants to talk to you. I said, well, all right, where's he? And they told me, and I walked across the street. And I walked in there, and there was four or five assistant prosecutors, federal prosecutors, sitting around a table with maps, trying to figure how to get from Kansas City to St. Joseph and go through Kansas to do so. That would then give them federal jurisdiction. And that's what they were interested in. They were all, you get a case like this, lawyers and sometimes judges want to hear them. They want to be a big shot. And everybody does, you know, something comes up why they want to be the hero, or a chance to be the hero. Sometimes they end up being the bum. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they were trying to figure that out because they wanted to get jurisdiction, and they'd be the heroes who could put those people in jail or death penalty. So I went in to see the district attorney himself, and he started shooting me out saying I was messing everything up, filing all this paper, had no business doing that, and chewing on me. And I said, look, I work for John Downs, he's my boss. He sent me down here to it. If you don't like it, you talk to him. And he started laughing. He said, okay. So then we got along all right. I told them then they were all upset about Hetty's husband, and they thought he had something to do with it. And I told him, I said, no, he's a businessman, he's no more, and he doesn't have anything to do with this at all. And I had the two deputy sheriffs that come down in the car, and they were going to get the two people and take them to St. Joe. But something happened and he didn't do that. They said, told us to go on home. So we did. I don't know, it was a very sad thing. People went nuts over the world over there. Two people from St. Joe, I don't know their names. They had a blue car, and they were driving on their honeymoon, I think, and had Missouri plates and St. Joe on it, and they were arrested back east somewhere because they were from St. Joe and had a blue car that everybody was looking for, and it wasn't them. But anyway, Bonnie Hetty's aunt hired Bill Rosenthal to be the attorney for Bonnie Hetty. And he was had been a prosecutor, and he was a trial lawyer, and a good one. But his wife, his home got so many telephone calls threatening him, threatening her, because he was going to represent Bonnie Hetty. And it upset his wife so much that he withdrew from the case because people were calling his home and just raising hell. So it, John Downs told me that, I said, Hall and Hedger decided that they'd rather be and get this over with, and they went to federal court. So they told them they had gone through Kansas and gave federal jurisdiction. And it was kind of a quick case. So I don't...
Bill Rosenthal.
William Rosenthal. Bill Rosenthal. That's on Bill and William.
Nobody ever really knew why he quit, did they?
Well, the lawyers and stuff, I don't think he didn't make a public display of it, but the lawyers understood him. He was around the courthouse, and that was a scuttlebutt. I don't know if Bill ever told me that's the reason he did, but that's what the understanding was. That, you know, if you get into high-profile stuff, people get very upset sometimes, and they're unreasonable. And it's just a mob instinct some people have.
So what was the atmosphere in St. Joseph like, you know, during once you knew that Bonnie Hedy was involved and you found the body?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't talk to anybody about it except in our office. John told me what to do, but I never thought very much about it. He said, do it, and I did it. Draw the charges. But
what was the newspaper coverage like? Was it splashed up?
Well, it was the newspaper coverage. Do you remember what it was like? I'm researching this. I went through our vertical files and all the old newspaper clippings, and I mean, it was seemed like it was day-to-day coverage.
Oh yeah, they covered that because we had two newspapers then, and I always felt like the morning paper was the better one, but they weren't the flagship. But they covered it. Newspapers were funny. One of the best things the St. Joe newspaper did I ever saw was when Truman fired MacArthur. There were two stories, one written by the Associated Press and one by the United Press. And the St. Joe paper ran both stories on the front page. And you could hardly tell they were talking about the same thing. I mean, one was in favor of Truman and the other was in favor of MacArthur. And sometimes you... And one newspaper reporter, you say, it's whatever I say it is.
Was there public opinion?
They're not too reliable.
I mean, you can ask.
Well, I didn't know if there's...
What?
Like, public opinion, you know how in today's world with all that goes on and you get the TV coverage and you sometimes get slanted from reporters and twisted. And I just wonder what public opinion was then. You know, did they get involved?
Oh,
they thought he
was guilty as hell. I mean, yeah. And their idea was that they didn't care. But I don't know. Things are different nowadays. They're bringing news media into it. One time, the news was going to try this. This was a judge going to try this case, and the television station ran a big story on Sunday night. They're going to start on Monday morning, and had ready handprints on the wall. And it was a pretty close, one-sided case, really. But they were given all the information that was supposed to come out in the trial. So I continued the case, they wanted to know why. I said, well, because of your publicity. And if you do again, I'm going to move it to somewhere else. Well, you want to do that, I will have to pay a reporter to cover it. I said, well, that's up to you, but I'm not going to have that. You got to have a fair trial. And of course, they're always worried the Second Amendment, knowing their right to do whatever they say, whatever they damn well please, but I was interested in the Fifth Amendment, which gives you a fair trial. But they don't care about that sometimes. And now, if you got a big case, I guess the main thing you do is hire a public relations man and get you on television, and you tell your side of the story on television, and they'll write it all, and they'll cry and ask for money and all kind of stuff. And it, we didn't wouldn't permit that. And I know I stopped when one time the guy, Omaha, and the Omaha paper and the New York Times both called me. Want to know why? I told them why. I said, I told them that I'd prohibited the lawyers from talking to the papers about the case before the trial. And they didn't like that very much.
So the day that they found the body.
Beg your pardon?
The day they found the body, you were there at the, yeah, the Heddy house. Can you tell me more just kind of about that day and
well,
what it was like?
I don't know. Well, it's their house, you know, this northeast of the intersection of Belt and Mitchell. I don't remember that exact address now, two, three blocks. But it was a nice day, as far as I remember. It wasn't raining anything. And Dick Martin had been in the house. But it wasn't, I think he sneaked in. He was FBI agent. And I think that might have been illegal. I don't know. But I don't know where the FBI got their tip. But it was just, as far as the day was concerned, it just for the ordinary stuff. It's like these things happen, you know, and it comes in the way prepared for it. What'd you want?
Well, I was going to ask, you didn't go in the house?
No, I didn't. Now, I think I did at one time, because I remember they, she had a, they had a slot machine in the house, I think, in their rec room, I guess you'd call it. Yeah, there was a slot machine in there for their own enjoyment. I remember seeing that. But, well, I know I had to try a murder case one time as a prosecutor. And this young fellow had killed all five members of his family. And he was a juvenile. And I talked to, not Starmer, but Burke, who was assistant chief detectives, I guess. And I wanted to get the, I said, what about the rifle that he used? And I said, we'll get his fingerprints on that. And Burke said, the fingerprints from two newspaper guys and three city councilmen were the only fingerprints I could identify. They just passed those evidence around those days. They just passed them here and there. Everybody got to look at it.
What year was that around?
Well, let's see. I hadn't been a prosecutor very long, so but 52. Three and four, about 56 or 57. And I tried to get him the death penalty, and the jury found him not guilty of a reason of mental insanity. And I guess I heard it later, he got out and turned out all right. He didn't come to see me, but he came to see my clerk saw him. I remember trying to another murder case at night, and the jury was out. And the judge says, Frank said, what are you going to do if the jury turns this guy loose? I said, give me back his rifle and tell him I hope there's no hard feelings. But they didn't. He shot a newspaper reporter. The guy was visiting with a girl who was engaged to one of his friends at the newspaper, and they were to Corby Grove, and this guy shot her, and then the guy ran, and she shot at him and missed him, and we got a confession, but he didn't know why he did it. He just was browned off at the world in general, decided to shoot somebody. So if you go parking around Corby, be careful who you park with.
Well, I just have one more question about the Greenleys.
Okay.
The FBI agent, Richard Martin, he was from St. Joseph.
Well, he was assigned here, yeah. Originally, I don't know, from Philadelphia or somewhere. He later became a lawyer, and a practicing lawyer, and a state representative. Richard M. Martin.
And so was he the first one to go in the house?
I guess so, and I'm not sure he had any. He didn't have any warrant or anything. I think that's why nobody talked about it.
So, well, I guess I have more than one more question, but after you found the body and the FBI wanted jurisdiction pretty badly,
sure,
right? So what did the prosecuting attorney at that time, Downs, what did he do? How did he feel about it?
Well, John Downs told me that J. Edgar Hoover called him and said he wanted to file a murder charge. So we did. Whether he did or not, I guess. All I know is what John Downs told me. And I didn't have any reason not to do whatever he said. I'm trying to think of some parallel case that had a lot of publicity, but I don't remember any right now. And,
were you ever afraid of anybody, any trial that was going on, threats or any kind of stuff? I was wondering about,
yeah,
what you see on TV.
Some guy, he was a gardener, he was picked up for armed robbery and had him cold, and he was down at the police station, and he wanted us to drop the charge, and he'd go join the army. This was armed robbery, and I laughed at him. I said, we're not going to do that. So he got mad and threatened to shoot me. And later on, he apologized and said, sorry, upset my wife. My wife said, I hope he knows which side of the bed you sleep on. You can't let those things get to you. And I had another time a guy said he's going to come to shoot me at Keith Marquardt from Colorado. I carried a pistol around a while in a briefcase. That's a damn nuisance carrying a gun.
Yeah, responsibility.
Well, this is why you were a judge?
Yeah. But I got it in a briefcase. It made my wife nervous all the time. They're heavy. And I don't know why anybody wants to carry one, but people do. I remember a case where two guys got in an argument down in some tavern. The guy went back to his car and got a gun, went in and shot the other guy and killed him. And had to sentence him, why he had to go to penitentiary. his family was one part of the courtroom crying and sobbing, and the family of the dead man was sobbing and crying the other part. So I'm not in favor of concealed weapons. I think if you want to carry a gun, carry it on your hip where people can see you that you got one. But there's a lot of people out there looking for a time to beat Billy the Kid and put a notch in a gun, I think. So I don't argue with people anymore. Yes, sir, you have the right of way. Go right ahead. You know why you get into an argument over somebody, then you know they're damn fools out there. And then some of them are looking for a chance to shoot somebody. Makes them feel like a big shot. So, you don't argue.
What led up to you becoming a judge?
Well, I really hated it. I was prosecutor, and I did a good job, I guess, as prosecutor, 4 years, assistant 4 years. And Judge Duval Smith, well, I think we were friendly. We were buddies and anything like that, but we got along fine. I liked Judge Smith. And he was up for re-election, and he could retire and with a pension of $500 a month. And I knew that if he got elected, I didn't have any power or any support, I guess, among the wheelers and dealers. I had pretty good support among the public. Yeah, there's a town called Taos. And in one election, I got all the votes. There were 8 of them. Anyway, so I figured if I wanted to get there outside, I wanted to be a judge. I couldn't. The agony of defeat never overcame. The thrill of victory never overcame the agony of defeat. I felt like I should win every case. And I really upset me to lose. But I thought, well, if I was a judge, I wouldn't be winning or losing either one. And I figured if he was to retire or something happened and there was an appointment, I'd never get it. So I decided to run for it. I ran against him on his pension of $500 a month, too much for anybody, and I won. I never enjoyed politics very much, but that's what you had to do. We didn't have any. I guess I had 5 elections and lost the first one and won the others, but one guy ran against me for prosecutor on a Democrat ticket, and 2 years later he ran against me on a Republican ticket.
I read where you ran unopposed a lot of the times.
After the first election, nobody ran against me for judge each time. After that, I had 5 more elections, or 6-year terms. And so I had 4 more elections. I used to take all my people that worked for me to the Barbosa's for dinner, for lunch, on the day after the filing was closed. I took all my friends who celebrated. They were glad too. They didn't have to campaign. I'm not sure how good a campaign they would. They'd been all right.
So do you want to talk about some of your other memorable cases that you did? That you served on?
Oh, I don't know. After I was finished my old job as judge, my entire term ran out. About a week before that, we got a call, and the clerk didn't know who it was, but finally she said, somebody's talking about Jeff City, wants to talk to you. And said, they're going to call back, and I said, what's their name? And they told me, and I said, oh, God, it's the Chief Justice. So the Supreme Court ended up with a case involving the custody of a girl between Billy Bush, the Beer's people and his lady friend. And how it got in the Supreme Court, I don't know, but they needed a special master. So they signed that to me. And so I went to St. Louis to try that. It took 2 weeks, I think. And the St. Louis papers went nuts over it. They were after me all the time, and I said, no, I'm not going to talk to you about anything. When I'm offered to send me some steaks, I said, no. And they said, well, we'll send your wife some candy. I said, she doesn't need any candy. I felt like asking if they were the only rich people in St. Louis, why they were so upset. But the Bush family was clear full of publicity. And they were rich. I guess that made a difference. But hell, St. Joe had one or two rich guys. But there were people just, I don't know. I remember it was a non-jury matter, and Billy Bush said people always challenged him, and arm wrestle in a bar or something, just challenge him. So he'd do it. And he beat the guy with arm wrestling, and then the guy grabbed him and they started to fight and rolling around on the floor, and Billy Bush bit off part of his ear. So it wasn't in the jury, and I said, what did that cost you? And he said, $500, I think, or $5,000 or something like that. His source of income was the beer distributorship in Houston, Texas. He got all the profit from that. He rode polo ponies. He bought this girl a car. I said, buy her a new one. Oh, no, I bought her a used one. But she was something else. He met her in a wet t-shirt contest somewhere. And I expect she probably won. She pretty promptly looking me up. Something else. But she'd go off and leave this child. The child's name would change Scarlett, and he had a half-brother named Ashley. But like she went off to celebrate Presley's birthday, a bunch of them drove off. She just left it with some whoever she did the child with. She was no mother at all, involved with drugs. And they found the child wandering around out in the streets in Los Angeles. But that caused a big uproar. And I didn't know whether I was going to get paid or not. Because I'd never had one, and they weren't paying all the gun. So they did pay me. And the Internal Revenue was going to get after me for not giving the money ahead of time. Estimated. So I wrote them a long letter and told them all about it, and they forgave me. But people get excited about other people that have money, I guess. I don't know. There was money problem with me. I got friends in high places like the library. She takes good care of me. And Mrs. Revels does too. My mother used to drive my little brother and I to, we lived near Fawcett, Missouri. And she drove in the summertime, she drove us both older, St. Joe, to go to the library, children's department, the public library. I can't think of anything else much. I enjoyed traveling as a judge after I retired. I filled in what they call a senior judge, and I'd be assigned around the state at my, sometimes it'd be Springfield or Sedalia or St. Louis, Kansas City. And I didn't know anybody, and they'd already fired their own judge or something happened. And so I was like a federal judge. We walk in. Let's go to work.
And how'd you meet your wife? What was her name?
Rita Sweater. Well, that's quite a story. John Downs and I were picking a jury, and he was going to strike this fellow off, and I said, he seems all right. What's wrong with him? He said, he's 30 years old and he's not married. Must be something wrong with him. And I got to counting up, and I said, hell, I'm 30 years old, John. So I figured I ought to get a wife. So I like girls, but I didn't want to marry one. And I went to a party at the country club, and I don't know who I was with, I don't know who she was with, but she had on a black strapless formal and a lot of blonde hair. She looked pretty good. And I knew her family, and I knew her sister in high school. So I wrote her, she was still in school at Columbia, at Lawrence, Kansas. And I wrote her a letter, asked her to come to something or other that the junior chamber was having. She agreed that she couldn't come because she got the measles. Somebody said, Frank, where's your date? I said, she's got the measles. Well, she was engaged to be married to Fred Kellogg, who was the older brother of Judge Kellogg. And he was flying back for the wedding. It was going to be on Saturday, and he's flying back Friday night, and the plane crashed and killed him the day before the wedding. I didn't know her. I knew him, and she was a mess. She had to drop out of school for a while. So we dated a while. I chased her. Took 2 years. Because I was 8 years older than she was. But it didn't work out that way. We married 53 years, 53 and a half. But
the Greenlee's murder was kind of at the beginning of your career.
I guess
assistant.
So.
What was the rest of your career like as an assistant prosecutor?
Well, I just tried whatever case it was handed to me, and I don't remember any of them in particular. When I was assistant and later I was prosecutor, I had that case with one. He killed five members of his family. I had a lot of murder cases. John Down didn't have any, and he always said people were scared of committing murder when he was prosecutor. But I enjoyed it, the trial. I didn't really hold the coat. I didn't want to win or lose. I figured if I'm a judge, that's it.
What year did you retire?
Well, I don't know. When my term was up, I was 86 or 87 or 88, somewhere in there. 30 years from when I started. Must have been 88 or 89. Anyway, I did senior judge work for a while. And then I did sometimes arbitration, mediation. And then I spent about 10 years working for company called FINRA, which is Financial Industry Regulation Authority. And if you buy stocks or bonds and have a dispute about the sale of them, then you have to go to arbitration. You cannot go to court. And so I tried cases, most of them were in Kansas City, and I had a couple of them in Omaha. But, because you see, if you had a lawsuit with one of those big companies and they had hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions, you'd have no chance to win at all. Because it just cost too much money. Unless you lost a million, the lawyer's fees would eat it up. So that's why they just devised this system. So I enjoyed doing that. That's how I got that big television set.
Did you see a change in crime as far as the severity, the types, the frequency?
No, there's always been criminals. Where I see the change in the law is that the lawyers settle everything in the civil matters. You hardly ever hear a civil case going to trial, and they settle. And the big problem with the practice of law, I think, was the same thing it did during World War II. The government wanted a lot of things built and done right away, so they gave them out on cost-plus contracts, and they could, so they'd pay the guy to build it X number of dollars plus his profit, a cost plus. And the lawyers got into that too. And so they make money by going through a lot of motions and running up the cost, and then they settle. And sometimes you have cases where they don't settle, but then Boulware got this case going against the Army Corps of Engineers. Not to be a different door, probably won't get settled. But and I know one company fired their lawyers because they kept putting more extra lawyers on the case and then make him pay for them. And they were learning, you know. It's best to stay out of law if you can. Just say you can have your way, don't argue about it.
Do you still follow kind of the crime and the court proceedings that go on?
Follow the what?
Do you still follow kind of the court cases that...
Well, I get them. I don't concentrate like I used to, but they send me every month the opinion of the appellate courts in the cases. And I can get them and read them sometimes. I don't do it as much in the last year or two. It's hard for me to concentrate. My mind wanders. And if I read something and I have to read it two or three times, then it comes to it's not worth it. I don't really give a damn.
Well, I have to do that sometimes.
Yeah.